We'll bring the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Yeruso, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? I'm sure you have. All members, Representative Yeruso moves the minutes.
Thank you.
From yesterday. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, motion prevails, the minutes are adopted. Members, today we're going to have an agency overview on mining. We'll hear from the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, and the EQB. And we'll get started right off the bat. If the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources would like to come forward. Mr. Jess Richards.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jess Richards. I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Department of Natural Resources.
Welcome to the
Thank
committee.
You. I have along with me today the Assistant Director of Minerals out of our Hibbing office, Peter Klevenstein. Pete's in charge of everything related to the economics and mineral potential, mining royalties, those sort of things, and everything that goes on in Hibbing for our office. And I also have along with me Joe Henderson. Joe is in charge of mine permitting coordination. So these folks will also be available at the end if you have questions that I can't answer.
Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you very much. So before we get too far into the topic of the day, I just want to give you a quick summary of what Lands and Minerals does. We're charged with managing 12 million acres of state-owned mineral resources for the benefit of all Minnesotans. We manage these resources through mineral leasing, exploration monitoring, mine development, and also through permitting. We issue the permit to mine for mining projects to ensure that projects are done in an environmentally sound way and reclaimed for future use. Lands and Minerals also provides real estate leadership for the management of over 5.5 million acres of state-owned lands. We handle everything from the leasing of lands for hunting shacks to acquisition of lands to sale of surplus state lands. We employ about 100 people with about half, a little over half, located in greater Minnesota in our offices in Hibbing, Bemidji, Brainerd, Grand Rapids, New Ulm, and then the remainder in St. Paul. So I was asked to come talk to you today and give you a kind of a high-level overview of what does Minnesota have for minerals in this state, what do we have for mining, what are some of the economics and benefits from this industry, and kind of talk you through a little bit, real briefly, on how a mine gets even created. So in 2013, Minnesota's mining and minerals provided $2.7 billion to the state's domestic product, according to Deed. And in northeastern Minnesota, these mining resources represent 30% of the gross regional product. So it's an important sector, and I'm going to do my best to help give you the basics on it. Oh, I must have skipped through a slide somehow there already. Oh, my goodness. All right. So Minnesota is fortunate to have some of the best mineral resources in the country, and we're number three overall in the United States for non-fuel mineral production. Minnesota's iron mines produce over 80% of the first pour steel raw materials in the United States, and they're a strategic resource that has been used throughout history in Minnesota. We also have arguably the largest undeveloped deposit of copper, nickel, and other precious metals in the world. We have great aggregate resources, which are the key to maintenance and growth of our local communities. And we even have dimension stone that is sought after across the country. So this next couple slides here will give you a broad look at the location of Minnesota's minerals. You can see that the areas in black are Minnesota's iron formations. You have the Cuyuna Range in north-central Minnesota, which was the nation's largest source of manganese. You have the renowned Mesabi Range, stretching 110 miles from Grand Rapids to Babbitt. Yeah, you have the Vermilion Range up near Tower in Sudan, which is home to the Sudan Underground Mine. It is still in operation as a state park and has over 32,000 visitors a year. If you haven't been there, it's a great trip. You get to go down in the mine, and it's quite an interesting visit. And you can see to the southeast of the Mesabi Range, you have the Duluth Complex, which, as I said, is one of the largest undeveloped resources of copper, nickel, and precious metals. There's been mining on all of our iron ranges and quite a bit of mineral exploration in the Duluth Complex. But much of Minnesota has not been explored and has high mineral potential. All of the areas in tan on this slide right here represent areas of potentially high metallic mineral deposits. There's been some limited exploration in these areas, but there's also been a lot of aeromagnetic flyovers and surveys like that that indicate there might be mineral potential in those areas. But they are, at this point, pretty much non-explored. So you've heard of our iron mining. You've heard of our potential copper-nickel mining. Beyond those, Minnesota has large deposits of what we call industrial minerals. These are things like dimension stone that's used for countertops, for large building projects. We have landscape stones, clays, peat. You've heard a lot about silica sand, and you'll hear more about that from the EQB later today. And one of the most common minerals in Minnesota is aggregate. And like I said, it's really a critical resource in our state for maintaining our transportation infrastructure and for overall development. When we talk about industrial minerals, we're really talking about surface-level minerals. And this slide shows that we have a lot of industrial minerals across the state. It's a little misleading because not a lot of those are accessible. A lot of our industrial minerals as surface materials are owned by the private owner of that land. And much of these materials are tied up in private ownership, or they are inaccessible due to zoning or other restrictions in an area. They're inaccessible for mining. But nonetheless, it's pretty interesting just to take a look and see what we have as far as minerals in this state. So this slide is just going to give you a real quick overview of where mining occurs in the state. And so I'm just going to kind of click through this, and you can see first we have the iron mining taconite plants up on the Mesabi Range. We have additional mining going on there for old tailings, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. We have an iron nugget plant there, and we'll get into that a little bit too. Industrial minerals. You can see we have granite, gabbro, limestone, quartz as you move across the state, southern Minnesota, western Minnesota. We have clay and a clay plant that makes clay bricks down in southern Minnesota. We have peat spread across the state. Industrial silica sand. Now, I don't think I have all the facilities on there, and I'll let EQB further refine that. And then we have crushed stones. So we have high-quality crushed stones and then just other crushed stones. And so you can see we have mining that occurs all over the state of Minnesota. It's very closely located with our infrastructure. So you can see where it matches up with our road system, our rail system, and, of course, one of our features that we have here that a lot of states don't have is our ports. So that's just a real high-level overview where mining occurs. There's one handout in your packet that I don't have on a slide. It looks like this. And this is just got a nice overview that you can keep of all the different mining operations that occur in Minnesota. Okay, so this is just a shot of some of our mining operations in action. I've got a few examples that I'd like to pass around, so I'm going to ask Pete and Joe to give me a hand here. First, we have Mesabi Black. This is a dimension stone that is mined in Lake County, Minnesota. And then next we have Kasota Stone, Vetter Stone, mined just north of Mankato in Kasota, Minnesota. I've got here Sioux Quartzite, which is often used for building material, mined near Laverne, Minnesota. Let's see. Now we get up to our iron range, and we've got a couple nice chunks of this is a chunk of ore from Hibbing Taconite. I think some of you may have received a magnet. I don't know if you got that in your packet. If not, I'll pass one around, but you can see that if you take your magnet and rub it across the piece of ore, it'll stick to the iron. So that's from Hibbing Taconite, and then also much of our iron ore waste products are now turned into two-dimension stones, too. They are used for countertops or brick or things like that, and this is a nice sample of a finished product off the iron range that's used for that as well. And then, of course, you know, we'd be remiss not to talk about our bread and butter right here, which is taconite pellets, which are 65% iron. My kids collected these off a railroad track somewhere near Duluth. And then we have also nuggets from Mesabi Nugget. This is 97% iron, a value-added mining material product that comes out of Minnesota and can be used in electric arc furnaces. And then last but not least, this isn't a finished product, but this is a piece of core from the Duluth complex. This is actually one of the pieces of core from the Polymet area. You can see in here that normally I'd want to take a sponge and wipe it on here because it makes it shine real nicely. But you can see the deposits here of potential copper, nickel, and other precious metals in this piece of core. A I've just got a few slides of some of our Dimension Stone in action. That Mesabi Black piece that you're seeing right now is currently mined in Lake County and is being used extensively at the reconstruction of the World Trade Center in New York for pavers, sidewalks, and landscaping. The primary client that they are selling to right now is the World Trade Center in New York, and we're shipping Mesabi Black out of this state every day. You've all seen Target Field, hopefully. This is that Kasota stone that you saw, the tan stone that's passed around. This is mined in Kasota, Minnesota, Vetter Stone Company. It's in all its glory at Target Field. It has a real interesting bounce off the backstop if you got a passed ball. But that's Kasota stone, so the next time you're out at Target Field, you can take a look at that Minnesota product. And then Sioux Quartzite is another product that you saw passed around. It's kind of a pinkish-colored stone. It was used in a lot of architectural construction of old, some of the old mansions and such in Minneapolis. So this is just an example of that material mined near Laverne. Okay, now you've got two maps in your packets that are a little bit large, and I think hopefully you've got enough space to spread them out and look at them. But the first one is of the Mesabi Iron Range, and I'm going to walk you through some of the operations that we have. These are our bread and butter of Minnesota mining right here, and I'll walk you through the operations that we have going on the Mesabi Iron Range. So as I mentioned, the Mesabi Range stretches 110 miles from Grand Rapids to Babbitt. There's been mining going on up in this area for 130 years, and there might be a little disagreement among scientists about how it was created, but kind of the prevailing theory is that some mountains were eroded, and iron and silica were eroded into an ancient sea, and the algae content was right, and marine algae content was right in this at this time about a billion years ago, that it precipitated out this iron and deposited, and it was now the Mesabi Range. So I'm going to give you a closer look. We're going to move from west to east, so from bottom left of the picture to the right, and talk you through some of the operations that go here. The first two that you see in the bottom left corner are magnetation, plants 4 and plant 2 near Bovee. Magnetation is a scram mining operation. They basically re-mine old waste rock stockpiles and tailings basins, and they recover the iron to make a concentrate that they sell to market. Magnetation's plants got started in 2009 with the most recent startup of plant 4 in the past month, and they employ about 370 people combined across their operations. As you move up the range a little bit, you can see Esser Steel. Esser Steel is currently under construction, and it's near Nashwauk, and the construction is generating about 225 jobs right now. It's expected this summer they're going to be up to about 700 construction jobs, and that would be a new operation on the range. Just past that, you see Magnetation Plant 1. This was the first scram mining facility, and it kind of set the stage for the reprocessing of old mine tailings and waste products. Just north of that, you see U.S. Steel's Keewatin and Taconite mine. Keetac employs about 395 people. It's one of the two U.S. Steel facilities in operation here, and it's been in operation since 1969. As you move up the range, you next see Hibbing Taconite, and this is operated by Cliffs Natural Resources, but it's a joint venture between ArcelorMittal, Cliffs, and U.S. Steel. HibTac has been in operation since 1976. It employs about 770 people. In this area, it was before HibTac. They once moved the city of Hibbing to accommodate mining up in this area. I think that's happened a lot on the range, actually, over time. next is Mining Resources, just south of Chisholm. And this is a joint venture between Magnetation and Steel Dynamics out of Indiana. This site supplies 80% of its concentrate to the Mesabi Nugget plant, and the rest goes to Magnetation. And just to the north of the city of Mountain Iron, I don't even know if you can see the city of Mountain Iron, but kind of at the middle of the screen there is U.S. Steel's Mintac Taconite mine. This is the largest iron mine in the United States and the single largest miner of School Trust ore. It began operation in 1967. It employs about 1,350 people. And this mine, along with Keetac, produces almost half the iron pellets on the range. So as the iron formation starts to turn back to the south, there's a little dip in it that's known as the Virginia Horn. And we see there ArcelorMittal, Minorca Taconite mine, and the Minorca operations, you can see, kind of stretch across the horn towards Gilbert and Bowabic. It employs 350 people, and it began in operations in 1977. And ArcelorMittal is the largest steel-making company in the world, and this mine is a critical source of raw materials. At the base of the horn, you see, near Eveleth, Minnesota, you see a United Taconite mine. This is another of the Cliffs Natural Resource Mines. Has ore reserves that stretch underneath Highway 53, a topic of much interest on the range today. UTAC began operation in 1965, employs about 514 people, and you can see that UTAC ships its ore slightly to the south for processing into pellets. Now if you jump a little bit more to the right, you see near the cities of Aurora and Hoyt Lakes, you find the former LTV mine site, which is now owned by Cliffs Erie. And within this site, we have the Mesabi Nugget Plant, which is the first of its kind in the world, producing that a nugget like you saw earlier that's 97% iron concentration. Nugget, as we call it, is run by Steel Dynamics. It opened in 2010, employs about 132 people. The LTV property is also home to the proposed Polymet plant site and tailings basin. We'll talk more about that in just a second. And then last but not least, on the far right side of the paper, on the end of the eastern end of the range is the North Shore Mine near Babbitt. North Shore mines and crushes its ore on site, and then it ships it over 47 miles to Silver Bay pellet plant. North Shore is the site of the first taconite mine in North America. Mining began here in 1955, and they employ about 572 people. So moving to your next map, this is taking a look at some of our deposits in the state with copper and nickel in the Duluth complex. So the Duluth complex was apparently formed when the continents were splitting apart and some mineral-rich magma shot up to fill the gap, solidified, and created what we have now as the Duluth complex. I'm not going to go through each one of the deposits that you see listed here, but I'm just going to highlight a few of them. You can see on the bottom end of the screen, or bottom end near Hoyt Lakes, there's a number of small deposits that are labeled encampment minerals. These are exploration sites that encampment's working on near the city of Hoyt Lakes. You've heard a lot about Polymet in the last year, so if you look up to the area just above that encampment, you see a dotted line that says Polymet Mining Corp. North Met Deposit. That is the location of the proposed mine site for Polymet. It'd be an open pit mine, and the ore would then be shipped by rail to the west back over to that LTV site where you can see that it says Polymet Mining Corp. This would be the plant site right there. It's right next to the Mesabi Nugget plant, and that'd be where the plant site would be and the tailings basin. Just north of the Polymet mine, you see Tech America's Mesaba deposit. And just to the north of that, you see Encampment Serpentine deposit. These are all copper nickel deposits that are in exploration phases. And finally, in the Duluth complex, you move to the north to the Twin Metals deposits. You can see the most notable here is the Maturi deposit near Highway 1 and just to the east of Birch Lake. This deposit ranges in depth from 1,000 feet below the surface to about 5,000 feet and could someday be a proposal for an underground mine. The project right now is in a feasibility determination stage by the company. Now, if you look to the inlet on the bottom here, we're going way south now of the Iron Range, down to Aiken County and Carlton County. And here we have a very unique copper-nickel deposit near the small town of Tamarack. It's a small deposit, but it's highly mineralized, and it's being explored by Kennecott Exploration Company. It's theorized here that this deposit was the result of an old magma chute leading to an old ancient volcano that existed in Minnesota. Okay, so just a little discussion on some of the benefits of the state's mining industry to the state of Minnesota. Metallic mining provides multiple benefits not only to the northeastern part of Minnesota, but also to the entire state. And our iron ore industry provides over 11,000 direct and indirect jobs. In 2012, which is our most complete data set for taxes anyway, it generated $119 million in state and local taxes. That's beyond mineral royalties. That's just in state and local taxes. In 2014, our iron ore mineral royalties set a new record of over $70 million. Which is distributed to schools, the university system, and local taxing districts. And overall, in terms of school dollars, the industry contributed about $93 million in taxes and royalties to schools. Zeroing in on the school trust fund, mining benefits schools across the state of Minnesota. Iron mining generated $53 million in royalties for the school trust fund in 2014, and the vast majority of that, about $51 million, came from the U.S. Steel Mintac mine. So the potential economic benefits of non-ferrous mining in Minnesota are also very significant. By way of example, if you just look at three deposits in the Duluth complex, that Maturi deposit just to the south of it, the Birch Lake deposit, and Tex Mesaba deposit, the estimated royalty to the school trust from those deposits is somewhere in the range of over $2 billion for the life of mining. This number doesn't include the potential for state and local tax revenues that would be generated as well. And then the Labovitz School at UMD also estimates that non-ferrous mining, if it came to fruition, could generate another 1,900 jobs if those projects came online. This next slide is just a quick summary of the state mineral leasing revenue by category. You can see that it's gone up quite a bit over the last 5 years, and a lot of this is due to the fact that the iron mines are mining more state ore. We've got pretty competitive royalty rates that we've negotiated with the mines. And the school trust balance has moved from about $700 million a few years ago to over $1 billion now. Just a couple more slides, so just bear with me here. This is just an overview of the steps to get to a mine. So, you know, really just a high-level overview. The first step is mineral leasing. This is getting state or private leases to go and look at a site or explore a site. The next step is exploration, which includes sometimes surface level work as well as exploration drilling. The next thing a mine would do is do an order of magnitude study. It's usually further drilling to further define the economics of a deposit to see if it's something that they'd be interested in mining. Then a company goes through what's called pre-feasibility studies. This is the what would the project look like, what would the mine look like, what are the economics of this thing. You know, and a lot of the Duluth complex work hasn't even reached that stage yet. Environmental review would be what happens next, and for any new mining project, it's almost always going to trigger an environmental impact statement and almost always a joint state and federal environmental impact statement. PolyMet is currently in that stage right now. And then permitting, for a large project like PolyMet, they may need over 20 different state, federal, or local permits. This is a stage where financial assurance is calculated for an operation. And then ultimately, all summed up into one bar is operation and closure, which is, of course could be a whole other presentation. But this is just kind of a high-level overview of kind of the steps it takes to get to a mining operation. So metallic mine permitting is facing a number of challenges and number of challenging issues. Environmentally, things like mercury reduction, sulfate, visibility in Class 1 areas like the boundary waters, deep seepage of tailings water, these are issues that stand out. There's certainly significant interest in the safety of copper nickel mining operations and issues like long-term water treatment. These are all things that are front and center right now. Financially, the DNR and its partner agencies are committed to protecting the state's interests, and we use financial assurance in the permit to mine to do that. And one of our biggest challenges today is looking at what are the right financial tools that should be in place for long-term treatment of water. As everyone knows, this really applies to all mining sectors, is that the overall level of public interest, opposition, and legal challenges to mining is at an all-time high. And as you know, PolyMet had over 5,000 people attend the public meetings related to mining. It generated somewhere in the range of 58,000 comments related to that project. And all of these challenges that I list out here today are interconnected. They require a lot of coordination between state agencies and federal agencies, and we've really made some great strides trying to get that coordination and make it a high priority. This is just a quick look at some of the government agencies that are engaged in mining projects and mining topics. For things like aggregate and silica sand, it's really handled more at a local level than it is at a state level, and you'll hear more about that from EQB. We have the state's mining sub-cabinet with DNR, IRRRB, DEED, and MPCA. You can see the federal agencies listed here, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, EPA, Army Corps, and Bureau of Land Management. And these are the three tribes, the Grand Portage Band of Superior Chippewa, the Fond du Lac Band of Superior Chippewa, and the Boys Fort Band are the tribes that are most engaged in mining projects right now. This is just some contact information for you. The folks listed here are representatives on the state's mining subcabinet group, staff representatives that can help you out if you have any specific questions about mining from each different agency. And this website here is the state's Minerals Coordinating Committee. This is made up of the DNR, MPCA, IRRRB, the Minnesota Geological Survey, the University of Minnesota, NRRI, and then appointed representatives from taconite, non-ferrous, and from organized labor, and industrial minerals and organized labor. And this website, if you're looking for more information, has a whole bunch of information on Minnesota's minerals, and it's kind of an interesting place to navigate through. So as you can see, you know, we're a state with abundant mineral resources. We've got a great mining history, and I think even a stronger mining future. And there are many tough challenges, though, that we have to work through, and we need to find collaborative solutions to get through them. But it's critical that we find those solutions. Our friends at Deed told me that one direct mining job created creates three more indirect jobs in areas like trucking or engineering or power generation. And statewide, the total effect of the mining industry is nearly 25,000 jobs. This is a photo here of the Cuyuna Recreation Area. It's a former mine site that's been reclaimed into a mountain biker's mecca. And so, it's just important that we do this, that we do it well. Minnesota needs mining, and the Minnesotans here are counting on us to do it right. So with that, I will take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I just wanted to point out a few things over the last few years that we were able to do. As a delegation, we were had given a few extra dollars to both the MPCA and the DNR out of the occupation tax, which is the mining's form of, a general tax that they'd paid the state. And I just wanted to say how great of a job I think they've done with that in keeping up with all of the PolyMet hearings, making sure that our permitting process is being followed and that the companies have the best chance of getting through, as well as the public tax access the information that people are looking for. And just wanted to say hats off to both of those agencies for all the work they did over the summer, making sure that a permit for a plant in my district, which was the largest producer, MINTAC, was completed during the midst of all that PolyMet debate. So I wanted to publicly say thank you on behalf of my constituents for getting that on. And not often will I get up and thank the DNR and the MPCA for all the great work they do. So enjoy today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Metza. Representative Enzal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned royalties paid by mining companies, royalties that are contributed by the mining companies to the Permanent University Fund and the K-12 Trust Fund. And of course, those royalties are only paid when the mining companies mine Section 16 and 36. Well, there's 34 other sections. And the fee owners of those minerals are private entities. I could name a few, like Rockefeller and Pillsbury and Great Northern Ore Trust and Sargent Land Company and a few others, but I won't name them. But my question is, do those private owners of minerals pay royalties in a similar fashion that the mining companies pay royalties on public land?
Director Richard.
Mr. Chair, members, we don't get to keep or get to see really the records on what the private mineral interests receive for their royalties, but many of them, my understanding is that many of them have similar royalty agreements with the mining companies as the DNR does. But they do not pay us So the private mineral holders do not pay the DNR a royalty in addition to, you know, what we gain from our state lands.
Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't prolong this. So then what in effect happens is the owners of the minerals pay the mining companies to mine the minerals, and then the mining companies provide a share of the profit to the owners of the minerals. And the people of northeastern Minnesota get zero.
Correct, Richard.
Mr. Chair, members, we're really trying to get a lot of state-owned property mined by these mining companies. And that is our priority, so that the people of Minnesota and northeastern Minnesota do get their piece out of these mines.
And I appreciate that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. I'm going to take a little different tack to represent Manziel's question. I'm not so sure that when the Pillsbury's and the Bennett's and the Longyear's and the Great Northern and all the people that he didn't mention mine, that we don't get any benefit out of it. Zero. Because we have to keep ore in front of the taconite mines in order to keep mining. That being said, my question is, and I do not know the answer to this, I know about if you earn income in Minnesota, and let's use a football player, that he has to pay income taxes on that income that he earns when he plays over at the what will soon be a new stadium. My question is, and I do not know the answer to this, do the fee holders, which live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and many other places, do they pay income taxes to the state on the income that's generated from the royalties within Minnesota?
Rick Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I do not know the answer to that question. Certainly, you know, even whether it's state ore or private ore, if the companies are operating, they're certainly generating taxes for the state, and maybe not royalties on private land, but they are generating taxes and jobs. But I do not know whether those mineral owners have to pay any taxes. Do you happen to know that? Okay. We'd be happy to look into that.
Mr. Chairman, if you could look into that. Then I was thinking back to a kinder and gentler day of Carl Sagan and how he described the galaxy, billions and billions and billions of, I think it was stars, he said. You start to sound like that for a few minutes about money that mining creates for Minnesota. Carl Sagan, that's pretty impressive. Have you ever compared the billions and billions and billions, and I won't add any more, compared to the 18 to 20 Fortune 500 companies in this state and how much they pay in taxes and, you know, to local and state government?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that, no.
That sure should be an interesting thing, considering the billions and billions and billions that come off of a 110-mile-long iron ore formation. I think that would be an interesting... Maybe they just pay way more than the iron ore formation, but that'd be interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Richards, do we have tax-forfeited land in the mines? If my recollection is right, anytime someone's had tax forfeited land, the state always keeps the mineral rights. Do we have any of those lands in active mines?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we do. I don't know the exact number. I could ask Pete may know where we're at with that, but we do have tax forfeit. The one slide that we showed here showed kind of the breakdown. I can go back to it if you'd like, of tax forfeit university and school trust.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question would be then, how is that money, if there is money, and I thought there was, how is that divided up between the state locals, and where does that go to?
Rick Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, that tax forfeit money is divided. There's a formula for it. I'll ask Pete to come up and describe it. But it is more going towards the local government ownership of that, so the counties, school districts, local municipalities in the area of the tax forfeit. Anything you want to add to that, Pete?
Mr.
You'd
Chair,
come up to the...
If it's something, Mr. Chair, that you think would be better for them just to get to us, whatever works.
Well, why don't you take a chair and state your name and who you represent, for just for the record, and if you have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Klevenstein. I'm Assistant Director of Minerals in the Division of Lands and Minerals.
Thank you. We need to do that for the tape.
Okay. The Representative McNamara, the tax forfeit revenue is 20% is withheld by the state for the mineral management activities then 80% is distributed locally. Of that 80% is distributed locally, 4/9 goes to the local school district that the mining occurred in, 3/9 goes to the local county that the mining occurred in, and 2/9 goes to the local municipality. It could be a city or a township that the mining occurred in. We're historically, we have not had a lot of tax forfeit minerals because when the Mesaba Range was discovered and the iron in the original survey, there were some very smart, wealthy people that realized the potential of that. And they've held on to their mineral interest and not allowed them to go tax forfeit. It is with this kind of change in the paradigm of the economics of iron ore today that we're seeing that the iron ore that everybody thought long term has been mined, and what we're looking at for new mining in new areas and new lease areas, much more tax forfeit is now being looked at. But that's really more the future than the what's occurred to date. But a lot of our new leases are now occurring on tax forfeit leases.
Just a comment real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the flexibility. That potentially could be an unbelievably terrific windfall for some local units of government, like a school district or such, because of I just think we saw one blast a couple of years ago up at one of the U.S. steel plants that when they said it went off, that was $1 million into the trust fund. So
yeah,
I think it will be interesting to see with the economic ramifications, and I think it just shows the important economic vitality of this region, and the potential is just awesome.
Yeah, it was a million tons, and that occurred in I think it was October that we toured. In 1 month later, that blast was mined out. That's how fast it was monetized.
Thank you. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first to Representative Dill's question, we had looked into this last year, I think, regarding when there's out-of-state fee holders. And from my recollection, and Representative Metz and I were just talking about this, but that royalty tax was dissolved in 1986, I think. So out-of-state fee holders don't have to pay what would be, equal to a income tax as players pay when they earn income in Minnesota. And we had actually discussed reinstating it last session, but that didn't happen for a couple of different reasons. So that's the best of my recollection on that. But if Mr. Richards wants to get more information, that would be great. And my question is regarding the school trust fund. And for the up-and-coming mines, SR, Polymet, Twin Metals, what are those on school trust lands? And do you have an estimated revenue that would be coming out of, say, SR into the school trust fund once they start mining?
Madam Chair, members, the Polymet does not have school trust ore. I'll just quickly do the other two, because Twin Metals, that potential facility, I believe their maturity deposit is about half school trust ore. I don't have an estimate other than when you combine those three deposits like we talked about. Do you happen to know whether ESSER's?
SR Steel has predominantly university trust is the state holding. There is some tax forfeit and there is some school trust, but it's predominantly university trust.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this will be something we'll probably be getting into. The school trust as well, my understanding is, looking in the map here, on the Duluth complex, if you look in the upper right-hand corner in the middle of all the green there, we find the Boundary Waters canoe area. And my understanding is there's quite a bit of land that would be school trust land inaccessible to anyone, say, using a canoe. You might pay a percentage of your fee for $5 or whatever it is to get to your campsite. But are there better ways we can work together in the future to make sure that more of that's accessible for either timber or mining, and maybe help educate the public, which I know you've been working on as well. But a lot of this land, kind of point of bringing this up, members, is trapped inside here. We can't access it and turned into a revenue-generating mechanism for the state. And really it's not about, we could trade it with land currently within the boundaries of a permitted operation and be creating revenue when we aren't. I know this has been an ongoing discussion, and I'll look forward to working on it with one of the new committees I got appointed to. So you don't have to answer that.
Any further questions? Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. And I think when you were speaking about the mineral rights and those folks that got the mineral rights, particularly in those are called severed mineral rights, I believe, severed mineral rights. And the reason I bring that up is that's important to know, because most of us on our deed don't have severed mineral rights. You know, when I bought my property in Crane Lake, my attorney advised me that I did not own the mineral rights. So I'm thinking back in my legislative district, particularly in Lake County, where there was a lot of consternation in the last couple of years about the executive committee delaying just the simple drilling to quantify minerals on private land. And that was half of one of those little cores that you saw here. They drill and make those cores. So I was wondering, and I had talked about, first off, I can't believe that someone would buy a piece of property and didn't know that the state or someone else owned the property underneath their house. That is beyond me. I can't believe an attorney wouldn't advise the client of that. Taking that a step further, I'm wondering, had Lands and Minerals thought about bringing forth legislation that requires, like, for example, a well disclosure? When you buy a piece of property, there's a well disclosure form that must be executed advising the purchaser of any wells that are on the property. Had we ever considered that from a point forward, had you ever considered that we would disclose so that nobody could be mistaken again in the future, at least hope so, the fact that they do or do not own the mineral rights?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, we do work with the real estate industry trying to make sure that that disclosure occurs at the real estate transaction process. And I'd have to ask Kathy Lewis whether or not we're doing it automatically. We've already got it embedded in some of the real estate forms that are used out there. What happens is that people look at 10 pages of forms in a closing and they don't read anything and they put their initials on it and they say, I'm good, and they don't actually look at it. So, yes, we certainly would value making it more, even more front and center that the state retains those mineral rights. And beyond that, I think we need to continue to find ways to educate Minnesotans about the mineral rights issue and how that relates to property rights. And it certainly is an important issue, and I agree that, you know, we need to keep working on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director Richards. So I sense that you've had this problem. I sense that we have that problem in this state. And, you know, I've bought a little real estate, and I've done just exactly what you said, initialed those things off. I just want to take it one step further. The seller has to disclose to the buyer who owns the mineral rights, just like a well disclosure. And that's very, especially in rural Minnesota, that is exceptionally looked at. Because when I bought my property in Coochin County, there were 5 wells on the property that came from previous farmers and all kinds of things that had to be closed before the transaction could close. And so I just think it's important for future landowners, and I can't fix the back ones in the past, to make sure they know. Because someday a drill rig might end up in their yard. And that should be considered by the buyer as a part of the purchase price that they're paying. My opinion.
Additional questions? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Representative Dill. When title work is done on real estate transactions, if there are any covenants that are of record recording or reserving any interest in property like that, those are known in the title commitment. And so the attending attorney, if a client or a buyer is represented by an attorney, and not all are, do have that title commitment. And if they're not reserved to the state or to another private party, then they inure to the benefit of the land or stay with the land. So that really is kind of taken care of, but people just don't dig into the minutiae of the fine print. it wouldn't change anything with a disclosure, really. I mean, because it would already be reserved to the state, or there would be a covenant reserved to somebody else who had prior title or prior chain of title in the property or interest in the property.
Is that a deal?
Well, I appreciate what you said, and you're correct. If you have an attorney and you do your due diligence, but that's where the buck stopped, because the governor's office was flooded by people, and the attorney general's office and everyone else by people, oh, my God, I don't want a drilling rig on my property, even though I don't own what they're drilling for. And many of them claimed that they had no knowledge of it. So I think it is beyond, regardless of all the things that you said, and I agree with you, we need to take one step further and attempt to at least educate people about mining because of the Carl Sagan billions.
Enzo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question might be more appropriate for Ms. Foss with permitting discussion. But my question is, once a permit to mine is issued to a privately held mining company who will extract minerals from private land, leased land, tax forfeited land, school trust, 1636, makes no difference. Is there a time limit? Is there a life expectancy of that permit to mine? Or does that permit to mine go away or sunset if a mine is not started?
Director Richard.
Mr. Chair, members, I think so. I think I'm following you now on whether or not one actually gets started at all. And so we've issued a permit to mine, and then they don't start operation.
Right.
At some point, the DNR would need to make a decision on whether or not to terminate that permit because it's not being utilized. So typically, when a permit to mine is issued, the mining operation will get started, and we will monitor the life of that mine. They will mine through their permit. If there's no expansions or any other growth, then we look for reclamation and closure, and we can go through a whole system. But if the actual mining doesn't occur, there's a point at which that the state would have to make a decision as to whether or not to cancel that permit. But similarly, though, we also are managing the mineral leases in certain cases in some of those permits, and so it's really in the state's interest to make sure those mineral leases, if they aren't being mined by the person that they're the company that they're issued to, would then get transferred to somebody else. And so it is important not only for permits to mine but also for mineral leases. Permits to mines can also be transferred if that needed to be the case in a certain project or something like that.
Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've answered my second question almost.
Okay.
I want to make it clear. Can a permit to mine issued to a mining company be transferred to another mining company while the construction of the mine is in process?
Director Rick.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we could make that transfer if we had parties in agreement. We could do that, yes.
Representative Dill.
Isn't an example of that Minnesota Steel and Iron to ESSER?
Director Richards.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that transfer occurred. There's been others in the past where we've made transfers of permit to mine.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Clementstein, thank you very much for coming up. And Director Richards, very good job. Thank you. Next, we're going to have up Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Ann Foss.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to provide a brief overview of the MPCA regulatory program as it relates to metallic mining. I'm Ann Foss. I'm the Metallic Mining Sector Director at the MPCA. Just provided you an overview of all the variety of materials mined in the state. The focus of the sector that I'm in charge of, the metallic mining sector, is taconite, iron nugget, scram, and non-ferrous operations. Later in my presentation, I'll briefly describe those operations. I have a small team at the MPCA that works directly for me, and then we coordinate with that in the agency to cover the major permitting and environmental review that occurs in the metallic mining sector, as well as being involved in policy development and things like even the moving of Highway 53, because that ends up involving a mine. We take a broad view of every project throughout the rest of the agency. Quite often when a company comes in, you get your air permit, your water permit. What my group looks at is the project from the whole perspective. We learned back a while back that, for instance, if a company decides to control their air emissions by adding a wet scrubber, that's a water type of thing that takes sulfur dioxide out of the stack, sulfate ends up in the water. That goes out into the tailings basin, and then the sulfate gets out into the environment. And now we look at things like that and talk more about what's the best thing overall for the environment, so that one particular, like the air media, isn't doing something that negatively impacts the water media. And similarly, we interact with the Department of Natural Resources continuously to ensure that, for instance, if we're working on a water permit, that we don't ask the company to do something on the water side that could create problems in a closure scenario, in particular a final closure or even a premature closure. What types of permits that we use to regulate the metallic mining industry, the major ones that we deal with are the air emission permits. There's two types there. As you'll see when I get to the facilities, there's a few that are small enough that they qualify for a state air permit. The others have federal air permits that are administered by the state. On the water side, we regulate discharges of water to surface and groundwater. And then we have, related to wetlands, a 401 certification that comes into play when there's a federal permit and the state wants to ensure that this is a mechanism that the state ensures that the federal permit doesn't negatively impact the state's ability to ensure protection of water quality. We are involved in other things like solid waste, storage tanks, and hazardous waste. For the air permits, we look at anything going out the stacks, but also fugitives. Those are things like dust created when trucks drive on the roads and things like that. Water permits protect surface and groundwater and ensure that state and federal standards are met. For instance, at a mine, when you actually do the mining, you need to have a dry pit. While you dig a hole in the ground, just like when your kids play at the beach, you dig a hole and the water flows in. You need to keep that dry, so you do mine pit dewatering. We regulate that discharge to the environment. We also are involved in environmental review. The state rules, the EQB rules, specify what types of project trigger environmental review. There's two levels of environmental review, an environmental assessment worksheet. The decision at the end of that is, do you need to do an EIS or not? And environmental impact statements. The rules specify which type of environmental review is required and which government agency leads that environmental review. For mining projects, that's DNR typically, and we provide the support for that. And some examples of the types of support is water quality, air quality, mercury, wild rice, and numerous other things. There's a lot of people involved in permitting and environmental review. For the air permits, especially the federal air permits, the EPA has oversight over that program and certainly has a lot of say in what's in those permits and has the ability to veto permits if they don't like those. In addition, on federal permits, some of the larger federal permits, the Forest Service and the National Park Service are heavily involved. They're what are called federal land managers, and we need to ensure that there are not things such as visibility impacts on the what are called Class 1 areas. That's like Voyageurs, Isle Royale, and the Boundary Waters. For air permits, we also coordinate with the Department of Health if there are health-related analyses that are required. On the water side, we coordinate an awful lot with DNR because DNR issues water appropriation permits, and we have to ensure that we have to understand what's happening there, because typically, where is that water going? Does it need a permit from us? And is there a better way to do the appropriation? We coordinate with the Lands and Minerals Division because they have the experts in rock characterization, so if we need to understand what the chemistry from the water coming in contact with the rock or the crushed rock, they're the experts in that and can assist in the modeling, et cetera, that's needed for us to understand what the outcome is going to be from a water quality perspective. And we coordinate with the Lands and Minerals when we are looking at potential for closure of a site and the financial assurance that might be required to ensure that water quality is protected during closure. We also have EPA oversight on water for the federal permits. There's been some very public instances of this in the recent year. For instance, EPA can object to a permit that is a federal permit. They approve standards that are proposed by our agency, and they are required to approve variances from water quality standards. In environmental review, many more agencies are involved. As Jess said, most of the environmental reviews for a new mining project are going to be joint state-federal, which means that DNR would be the state lead, and then you would, for instance, on PolyMet, the Army Corps and the Forest Service are co-leads on the federal side, and then you have EPA as a cooperating agency and three tribes that are cooperating agencies. So there's a lot of involvement. The tribes also are involved. We have, like today, we had a quarterly meeting with the tribal governments in the northern part of the state. DNR and the PCA do that regularly. Our agency also on larger permits sends when we send a draft permit before it goes on public notice, we send it to the company, if it's an EPA-related permit, to EPA and to the tribes, so they all see it before we put it out on public notice. So there's a lot of people involved. I'm going to briefly walk through the types of metallic mining operations that we regulate. There's taconite, iron nugget, scram, and the proposed non-ferrous. And you all have Jess's map that has the facilities on it. So there are six operating taconite plants. All of them have federal type air permits. They're very large air sources, so they're subject to the most complex federal air permit program. Most any change they make at their plants triggers a complicated modification to their air permit. And they also all have a mix of a state and federal water permit. And these cover their plant, their tailings basin, and their mine. In the ownership I have on here too, as Jess said, Hibbing's taconite is kind of the complicated one. Cliffs Natural Resources manages it, but it's also owned by U.S. Steel and Arcelor. The other taconites, SR Steel, is under construction. They have a water permit and they have an air permit. And Cliffs Erie and Duncan, now I separated these a little bit differently than Jess did. The former LTV property, the only part left that's owned by Cliffs Erie is the plant site and the tailings basin and then the Duncan pit. The Duncan pit was one of the first pits that that LTV mined in, and it's actually at the very end of the range. You have the Cliffs Erie prop mine, and then you have the Peter Mitchell pit, which is North Shore's pit, and then there's the Duncan pit, so it's clear at the end. And those are currently all owned by Cliffs Erie. They're natural, Cliffs Natural Resources, and our water permits is specific that it's only for a closed facility. Then there's the Iron Nugget operation. This is actually a commercial scale pilot plant located on a portion of the old LTV property. They make 97% pure iron nuggets that feed mini mills or electric arc furnaces. And from an environmental perspective, this is a great process. I was involved with this from its infant stages when it was first conceived as a, it resulted as from a visit to, not Kobe, to Japan. And they, it was brought over, there was a pilot plant built, the state was heavily involved in that. Environmental data was gathered from the pilot plant, and then this commercial scale pilot plant was built. It's taken a long time for them to get it up and running well. The benefit from an environmental perspective is that it combines, for taconite, you have the mine and the pellet plant, and then it is shipped to a blast furnace. And part of what's needed for a blast furnace is a coke oven. So there's a lot of intensive process. For the Iron Nugget operation, what's appealing from an environmental perspective is that it eliminates the need for coke ovens, and it goes straight to an electric arc furnace. They have a federal air permit, and they do have a federal discharge permit for water. The Scram mining operations are the magnetation plants. This is an interesting venture. I actually have the owner incorrect on this. It's actually currently a joint, where it says magnetation, it should be a joint venture between Magnetation Inc., who is the majority owner, and AK Steel. And these plants have state air and state water permits. They do not have a discharge to surface water. These plants utilize magnetic separation technology to get iron ore units left from previous mining operations that existed on the Iron Range dating back to the 1890s. This is the old natural ore tailings basins. So they're going in and taking what was waste and getting a usable product from it, an iron unit. Then the copper nickel group, you have Jess's map there. The one that we're currently involved with is the North Met project owned by PolyMet. Actually, the photo is of the former LTV plant site, which PolyMet is proposing to reuse that facility as part of their operation. It is currently involved in environmental review, and our team is supporting the DNR and providing technical support for that. And once it gets through environmental review, no permits can be issued until there's a decision on environmental review. We would have a major air permit, a water permit, and we would be involved. The Corps has a wetland permit, so our agency would have a 401 certification also. The others are Twin Metals, which today there was an announcement that Antofagasta obtained all the necessary approvals and applications to complete acquisition of Duluth Metals Limited. So there's a new owner involved in that operation. Kennecott and Tech, the ones that Jess talked about, all our involvement's been with them as they come in and talk to us about, they recognize now the need for a lot of background information like background water quality monitoring data and things like that to help support them once they get into environmental review, and they're having conversations with us about that kind of thing. And that's all. Any questions? That was pretty high level.
Questions? Members? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Foss, we've got a manganese deposit in the Emily area in Crow Wing County, and Crow Wing Power owns the mineral rights to that. They've done some exploratory and some testing there. Do you know off the top of your head what permits they've had to deal with so far?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members, I think they went through an environmental review when they did that, and I don't believe we had any permits. We've been involved. Our water quality staff have been involved in the environmental review, but that's our involvement so far.
Okay. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you could give me an idea of Minnesota's permitting and the processes we put the companies through here comparative to, you know, you mentioned some names of mining companies that operate in many other places in the world. What kind of standards do we have here in Minnesota comparative to other states and countries, and would you say we're leading in terms of our quality and permitting?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members, in particular on the water side, it's complicated. Certainly, we have a challenging standard, 10 milligrams per liter standard for wild rice is a challenge to meet. That standard doesn't exist anywhere else. We believe that our state is very protective of its natural resources and pride ourselves in that.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that, and you know, I just more so wanted other members on the committee. I think this is our first time with an actual mining committee in the House. But Minnesota, I am proud to say as well, we do have great standards, some of which I don't all agree with. The example you just mentioned being one of them as far as the number goes. But overall, you know, I think we should be cognizant as a state of, you know, where we do get these minerals. And, you know, there are other countries where there are zero standards and waste is dumped into rivers, kids are doing the work. And, you know, I think it's important we remember, even though things can get controversial in terms of how we're doing them, that we do them very well here in Minnesota. And oftentimes, in the case in my district anyway, at some of the most competitive costs per ton in the world. And I'm proud that our workers up in northeastern Minnesota produce the more tons per man hour than anywhere else. And as far as I can tell, no one's coming close so far, maybe with Australia on their production coming online. Might see a little bit more because they're back into the raw ore. But just want to point that out for the committee and members here that we do a good job, and I'm proud of my constituents and represent the most mining-centric district in the country. Second would be Representative Moline.
Representative Enzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhat related to Representative Metza's question and comment, seems to me a lot of observers of our mining regulatory system and permitting process that more times than not, federal statute and rule dominate state statute and rule, preempt state statute and rule, with one really interesting exception, which is the sulfate standard rule of 10. How does it happen that the Chicago Regional Office can just simply choose what Minnesota state statutes and rules to adhere to and which Minnesota statutes and rules that they choose to preempt?
Director Foster.
Mr. Chair, members, I think in particular I can tell you're concerned about the wild rice standard.
Sure.
Under the Clean Water Act, the state's proposed standards to protect protect the water in their state. Those standards go to EPA and are approved by EPA. And so EPA approved that standard. In order to change that standard, the change needs to go to EPA to be approved also.
I'm fine, thanks. I'm not fine, but
Representative Dill.
I don't have another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Foss. Thank you for all your work. This is very detailed and tough, and you're always available and willing to explain it, whether we like it or not. Now, my question is if the EPA has set the standard and we have to follow that standard based on some recommendation that was made to them by this state, how is it that wastewater treatment plants are exempt from that when they send water directly into a wild rice receiving water, but yet their permits come out with no that are in violation of the standard?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members, this agency has developed a wild rice sulfate standard implementation process through permitting. And in order to put limits in a permit, you really need monitoring data. As part of developing the permit, you look at the discharge data and ask the question, does it look like the discharge would cause an exceedance of the standard? And typically, because, as you know, there is a lot of variability in the discharge there can be throughout the year, we like to have at least, you know, more than a year's worth of data. For most, so what we've started out doing, and we've done this regularly with a number of our standards as we go to start implementing them, is we first get monitoring data. And so we've been, the first step has been adding monitoring to, for instance, the municipalities' permits. The mines have all had monitoring for sulfate for a long time. So we have lots of monitoring data on them, and we are starting to accumulate that kind of data on municipalities and on other industries. And then the next step is when they come up for reissuance to assess whether or not a limit is necessary in their permit to protect the wild rice water.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Foss. Has there been any estimates of what it might cost municipalities statewide to meet a 10 standard? I mean, what it might cost the general public and how much sewer rates might go. And I have one community that has $150+ sewer rate a month. And if their plant doesn't meet the 10 milligrams, what that might cost? Seems to be, having looked at a whole bunch of plants, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with mining. But it does have to do with mining, because I believe it was Hewat and Taconite signed a permit that had 10 milligrams per liter. And consequently, the price of ore dropped and they aren't building. And their company won't invest with that in the permit. At least that's what we believe. So, I mean, sometimes somebody's going to have to pay for all this, and I just wondered if you had an answer or you could direct me to that answer. Has there been studies that determined what it might cost statewide in billions, Carl Sagan billions, to pay for the sulfate standard that we don't even know if it's real, and most of the data I'm understanding, at least that I'm told about, says that it's not?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair members, I don't know that our agency has done an analysis of the cost of implementation of the existing standard. That would certainly be part of a rulemaking for the future standard and assessment of the cost. But I'm sure there may be municipalities that have made estimates of those costs.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, and Representative Dill already touched on it, but just for clarity, I mean, we always talk about this standard when it comes to mining, but the fact of the matter is the law doesn't say that it only applies to mining. It's supposed to apply to anyone that discharges in wild rice waters, wastewater treatment plants, agriculture, some other industry. So I just, you know, wanted to make that clear for the committee and the public that, you know, there's nothing that singles out mining. It's just that we talk about this issue when it comes to mining, but it's supposed to apply to anyone that discharges in wild rice waters.
Last question I can't figure out, Mr. Chairman.
On this point,
mm-hmm.
Representative Dill.
So I can't figure out, when permits are issued, if we even know what wild rice receiving waters actually are. Now, I mean, in my community, my small community, we have a mechanical wastewater treatment plant, and the community discharges into the Pelican River, which ultimately goes into the Voyageurs National Park, and if that isn't a wild rice receiving water, there aren't any in the state. But where can I go to find a list of wild rice receiving waters that then a community, let's just use a community, not a mine, let's move away from mining, could say, look, we better have an engineering study on this because this might cost us $500 million to fix because we go into a receiving water. That's what my communities are asking me, where can they find that? And this isn't something about you. This is about, you know, this isn't you and I fighting each other. I'm just trying to get the lay of the land here because you do a great job.
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that list doesn't exist. When the rule was written, what a wild rice production and water was not defined. And so that is a challenge in implementing this standard. And certainly when we work on the new standard, we will make sure that it's much more clear where it applies. What we have done on the couple permits that we've put out there so far, and we're evolving this, is we had a small group of people that involved even botanists from DNR where we looked at data on a lake. For instance, in the Keetac situation, the company went out and they hired a consultant, did a wild rice survey that looked at the number of plants, what the density was, what the ambient, what the water quality was in the lake, a number of things like that. And we sat in a room, looked at the data, and made a staff recommendation as to whether or not the standard should apply there or not. And then we presented that to the tribes. The tribes provide us feedback. We get back to the tribes. And at any point, if somebody provides additional data, we need to consider that and reevaluate it. And it's a very intensive process, which is difficult.
Last question.
Representative.
So you provided the information to the tribes, and some people got around and subjectively decided where the wild rice receiving waters were. And so what was that done for the people, or the people of Cook, or the people of Badette, or the citizens of Roseau County consulted on these determinations for the existing? And frankly, let's start with the list, Pelican River, I'll admit it, and then that's end it there. And this will be a whole lot easier. But that's a personal opinion. And I see Mr. Kadelka smiling. He used to work with me, so he's enjoying this, I'm sure.
Director Foss, comment?
Mr. Chair, members, I want to be clear. We did it on when we were talking about a specific permit and a specific water. We did not develop a list of waters. And the way other people got involved is any permit, water permit that we issue, first goes out on public comment. So the public has a 30-day opportunity to make their feelings known, and that was the public's opportunity to say if they disagreed with the conclusion that we had reached that the standard applied there. And then once our board decided to issue the permit, there was an opportunity for the company, for anyone else, to sue the agency on that decision. That did not happen.
Okay, a couple more folks have some questions, and then we're going to move on to the EQB. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Foss, thank you for being here and for handling some relatively easy questions. I've got one more. Will the agency be coming forward with a proposal to do additional wild rice sulfate testing in the governor's proposal that will come out in the next day or two?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have no idea.
Well, yeah.
I'm
in my little world with
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mining sector, and I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Until the budget comes out, they're not
talking. Yeah. Well, I was trying. Director Foss, I'll try one that's a little bit easier yet. Will the department be coming out with the next phase of the mesothelioma study and how they're going to fund it?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the state agencies are looking at the School of Public Health study that involves the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Health, the MPCA. We've even been meeting with IRRRB and DEED, all the mining subcabinet agencies, plus MDH, and we have not yet developed our thoughts related to the conclusions in the school in that School of Public the School of Public Health did the study. The School of Public Health got the funding, and we are trying to understand what their findings. They did a stellar job gathering information and drawing some conclusions from that, and we're, you know, we have lots of other contexts to think about this in, and we're not ready yet to talk about our any conclusions we have.
Thank you.
Representative Dill, you had a follow-up?
Yep, one more. On the idea of public notification on the development of the wild rice receiving waters, so I heard you talk about permits, and if you had a permit, you'd be notified that this was happening and you'd be involved. But if a town that had a permit before all this hullabaloo started a few years ago, when it was discovered by one of my district, one of my constituents, this problem, how would a community that wasn't seeking a permit, that was operating under a permit that lasted for some period of time, know that this was going on? Pick a town A that's on what they believe is a wild rice receiving water, but they don't even know that that's an issue, and they're not seeking a permit. How would they know to get involved in this process to make sure that they had their bases covered, whether it be looking at spending money in the future or whether they were even on a wild rice receiving water? That's, I don't quite understand the answer to that.
Rick Boss, comment?
Mr. Chair, members, it is challenging. We suggest that if somebody's thinking about making a change to their facility, that they come in and talk to us, because there isn't a list, and we can provide some guidance to them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm new to this legislature thing, second term starting, and just had a couple questions regarding rulemaking processes. Are there any rules or ideas that currently people in an agency might like to enforce but aren't rules that are actually enforced because someone likes the idea?
Director Foss.
Mr. Chair, members,
I need to explain that better?
Do you have one that you know of?
No.
I don't recall any. No.
Mr. Kadot, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadok. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And the question is, are there other policies out there that are being enforced as a rule? The agencies, all state agencies, enforce the rules or statutes, and that's what the controlling document going back to, guidance in that. If it is to be treated as a rule, it needs to go through the agency.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sorry?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
So
my understanding is it's not a typical practice to enforce a rule that hasn't gone through a rulemaking process. And am I correct in that assumption?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, to become a rule, that needs to go through the rulemaking process.
So currently there aren't any rules that you enforce that haven't completed that process?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the rules are the rules. Is there a specific example that you have a question on?
Yep, now I do. Okay. So my question would be, my understanding is the rulemaking process has not been completed in designating waters. How can we enforce something where a rulemaking process hasn't been completed, and where does the agency get the authority from the legislature for that?
Director Boss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's a disagreement. There's different legal interpretations. Our agency disagrees with the interpretation that says that we haven't designated waters yet. There's legal meaning to the word designation, and certainly that there is a legal theory that's been put out there by some entities that use that legal argument that we can't apply it because we haven't yet designated the waters. We have designated the use. We have not specified the waters that have that use, the very specific waters. It's a nuance, and the attorneys will have a lot of fun.
Okay. Director Foss, did you have someone else that was going to come up? Was Mr. Smith?
Yes, Mr. Smith was going to come up and do his.
We could, Mr. Smith, thank you for coming to the meeting. If you could be very brief, we've got the EQB that would like to come up and say a few words, and we might have to bring them back next week if we run out of time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Smith, I'm the Director of the Industrial Division at the PCA. It's a pleasure to be here. Actually, my goal today was to fill in the rest of the story around the non-metallic mining activities around the state that have to do with air and water permitting. That stuff is much less interesting and much less controversial. So I can kind of churn through this pretty quickly, or I could offer to give up the seat for Mr. Seufert to talk about silica sand mining in the interest of time.
Members, any questions for Mr. Smith? Or should we bring up EQB? Mr. Smith, thank you for coming forward today, and thank you for being here. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to bring up the EQB. Thank you for coming to the meeting today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Smith, for ceding your time.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will Seufert, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. And with me is Ms. Heather Ahrens. She's the silica sand lead for the Environmental Quality Board. Thank you for the invitation to present to you this afternoon. We were asked to make a presentation about silica sand in Minnesota, the role of the state, and the role of the EQB in coordinating this effort. This is a two-part presentation. Today we're going to provide an overview of the EQB as it relates to mining in Minnesota. And
Director,
if time
we'll have to we're only here till 4:30, so we'll have to make it short.
We will move quick, and if time allows, we'll present a little bit more of an overview on silica sand.
Thank you.
The board is made up of 9 state agency commissioners and 5 citizen members appointed by the governor. The chair, also appointed by the governor, currently is Department of Agriculture Commissioner Dave Fredrickson. The board was created in 1973 with the passage of the Minnesota Environmental Protection Act. The principal responsibility of the EQB is the oversight of the Environmental Review Program, providing technical assistance to agencies and local governments, designated as responsible for implementing environmental review, as well as support to project proposers and the general public. The board serves as a coordinating body on various interagency, multi-jurisdictional efforts, in this case, silica sand regulation. The EQB also provides direct access to the heads of 9 state agencies in a public forum on a regular basis. I have a small staff to support board activities, so we work closely with member agencies to access expertise. As I indicated in the last slide, the environmental review oversight is the principal responsibility of the EQB. The objectives of the program are laid out on this slide and come from Minnesota Rules 4410-0400. Environmental review is a delegated program. The board establishes the rules that determine what types of projects are required to do environmental review and which government entity is responsible for conducting the appropriate review. EQB staff provide technical assistance to implementing agencies, project proposers, and the general public, publish the monitor, process citizen petitions, and produce guidance documents. The EQB does not typically do environmental review. That is done by state agencies and local governments, with some exceptions. As it relates to mining in Minnesota, environmental review takes the form of either an EAW, Environmental Assessment Worksheet, or an Environmental Impact Statement. An EAW is a brief document which is designed to set out the basic facts necessary to determine whether an EIS is required for a project, for a proposed project, or to initiate the scoping process for an EIS. This document is prepared in worksheet format to rapidly assess the environmental effects which may be associated with a proposed project. Where there is potential for significant environmental effects resulting from any major governmental action, the action shall be preceded by a detailed environmental impact statement prepared by the responsible governmental unit. The EIS shall be an analytical rather than an encyclopedic document, which describes the proposed action in detail, analyzes its significant environmental impacts, discusses appropriate alternatives to the proposed action and their impacts, and explores methods by which adverse environmental impacts of an action could be mitigated. The environmental impact statement shall also analyze those economic, employment, and sociological effects that cannot be avoided should the action be implemented. To ensure its use in the decision-making process, the environmental impact statement shall be prepared as early as practical in the formation of an action. The slide breaks down what level of environmental review is done for mining projects, both metallic and non-metallic, and who the RGU is. These categories are broken down in Minnesota Rules 4410, and these categories were created in 1982. In short, environmental review for metallic mining projects is done by the DNR. Environmental review for non-metallic mining is done primarily by local governments, with some exceptions such as peat mining, which is done by the DNR. This is being further discussed with the current rulemaking underway for silica sand projects. And there are also some exemptions to the metallic mining categories for scram mining, general mine site activities, and processing expansions of less than 10%. The 2013 legislature established an interim threshold for environmental review for silica sand mining, processing, and transloading facilities. The legislature also directed the EQB to amend its rules for environmental review, adopted under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 116D, for silica sand mining and processing to take into account the increased activity in the state and concerns over the specific operations. The EQB shall consider whether the requirements of Minnesota Statutes 116C.991 should remain part of the environmental review requirements for silica sand and whether the requirements should be different for different geographic areas of the state. This directive is currently in process, aided by the input of an advisory panel. Previously, I mentioned that the EQB typically does not do environmental review, but noted an exception. This is the exception. In 2013, at the request of various stakeholders and local government units, the EQB found that the Minnesota Sands Project, consisting of 11 proposed facilities in four counties, was a phased action and exceeded the mandatory category for an EIS for a non-metallic mine, and the EQB was designated as the RGU. The proposer agreed to do an EIS. Minnesota Sands recently submitted payment to begin the environmental review, and yesterday submitted a signed cost agreement with the state to move forward with the scoping. We will begin working with the project proposer to establish a timeline and begin the scoping process. Regulating silica sand mining, processing, and transport in Minnesota is a patchwork of state and local efforts and has been evolving in large part since the issue came on the radar of policymakers in 2012. These are the state agencies that are currently involved in some level of silica sand industry oversight. Outside of our environmental review responsibilities, think of us as a conduit or connective tissue between state agencies, local governments, and the general public, clearinghouse for information, and a source of support for our local partners, project proposers, and the general public. We will get into the board's work on silica sand issues with more specificity at the committee meeting on the 27th. Now, if time allows, Heather can provide some background about the resource, potential impacts, and other considerations, unless, Mr. Chairman, you want to hold that until next week.
We've got a few minutes. Why don't we go through that now, if we can, if it's pretty brief.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Heather Ahrens, and I represent the EQB as the silica sand technical lead. The next couple of slides are to provide some high-level background information about silica sand mining, and the market trends driving the demand for silica sand. The intent of this information is just to provide some context about the role of the EQB in relationship to the silica sand mining. Silica sand differs from your average sand and gravel mine in Minnesota's typical gravel pits. The sand is very uniform in composition and grains, are round in shape. The sand underwent unique geologic processes to leave behind only rounded grains of quartz, which occurred 400 million years ago. The hardness and the durability of the quartz is one reason why it's a desirable mineral for industrial applications. Sand is mined from silica-rich sandstones that are found in southeastern Minnesota and associated with other layers of sedimentary rock, like limestone and shales. There are four silica sandwich limestones that are sources of silica sand: the St. Peter, Jordan, Wanawak, and Mount Simon. These sandstones are not just mineral resources, but water resources as well. The sandstones serve as a regional aquifers and a source of water for homes, cities, farms, and industry. The biggest user, as you're aware, of silica sand is oil and gas industry. According to 2012 United States Geologic Survey yearbook, 62% of silica sand produced nationally was for oil and gas. Although the numbers for 2014 have not been released, it is expected that oil and gas consumption will have a larger percentage of consumption. The oil and gas industry also has some of the more stringent specifications for silica sand. Only a subset of the world's deposits of silica sand meet the specifications required for frac sand. So the Midwest hosts a global resource. It's an important to note that other industries use silica sand too. The second largest user is the glassmaking industry, which nationally consumes 16%. Foundry sand, which consumes 9%, and there are 26 foundries in Minnesota. Other local industries that use silica sand include construction, aggregate, fill for bases, base for roads, as well as agricultural uses, specifically dairy production and use of silica sand and cow bedding. Here's a map produced by the Energy Information Administration showing where active oil and gas drilling is occurring. It's important to note that Minnesota does not have oil and gas deposits, but we do have the silica sand. It's been widely reported that the method for drilling oil and gas, commonly called fracking, is driving demand for silica sand. Well, fracking has been around since the 40s. But being able to accurately drill horizontally has changed how oil and gas is being accessed. A well is drilled vertically to depths of 6,000 to 9,000 feet, and oil-rich layers, which can be sometimes only 10 feet in thickness, are drilled horizontally in multiple directions. The process of fracking uses a mixture of water, sand, and chemicals. Geologically, accessing these formations are more predictable than the conventional oil plays, where oil deposits need very specific layers, folding and faulting, to trap the oil and gas. As a result, conventional oil wells are shifting to horizontal drilling and larger fracs and increasing the use of sand. What has not as been reported more recently is that a more recent trend that occurred in 2014 is that oil and gas production was found to increase well production with the use of more sand. According to trade websites, some large wells in Texas are being fracked with 2.5 million tons for a single well. And to put this into context, this is roughly equivalent to the annual production of frac sand coming out of Uniman. So in essence, 2014 has been known as the year of the sand. Here's a table showing production of the silica sand industry in Wisconsin and Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have 9 mines permitted to produce silica sand for industrial applications. Only 6 of these 9 sites are significant producers of silica sand. In Wisconsin, there are 63 active mines and 58 inactive mines. These numbers are from May of 2014. In Minnesota, we host around 7 to 10 processing sites. Some mines sites also host processing plants, so they doubled up in some instances. The sites range from sophisticated plants that have machinery to dry and remove fines, for which there's approximately 5 with a 6 in construction, to just a screener in a gravel pit that's screening out coarse material and then being transported for further refinement. Minnesota is near its capacity, meaning that the sum of all permitted facilities are producing either at or near their permitted rates. Here's just where silica sand is located and where mines are located. The orange represents the distribution of silica sand within 50 feet of the surface and the distribution of mines, processing plants, and transloading sites. The map, to accurately portray the activity in southeastern Minnesota, there are 2 mine sites in Winona and Fillmore that are permitted to produce silica sand for industrial markets, but it's to my understanding that they're only serving local uses. In Minnesota, most of the production of silica sands occurring in the Minnesota River Valley. These sites tend to be self-contained with mining, processing, and loadout occurring at the site. In terms of processing, transloading, the remainder of the sites that the state accommodates, sand mined from Wisconsin, being transported from Wisconsin, and then being transloaded or processed in Minnesota, with a hub of activity is centered in the city of Winona. It's important to note, too, that the regulatory landscape for who permits and sites these mines is done at a local level. So this can range from counties giving the permit to mine to down to townships. And the variability of the comfortability of how counties feel about this ranges, too. In some counties, they have actual mineral districts where they inform landowners that they are in a mining district, and so that's recorded on a deed to townships who are negotiating, you know, large mine sites. So there's a wide variability of regulatory oversight in terms of, I call it the quilt of Minnesota, and this is true for sand and gravel as well as silica sand. And the other...
Ms. Aarons, we're going to have to wrap it up because we're out of time.
Sure.
I think you're pretty much done with your presentation anyway.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And, Director, thank you for being here as well. And, members, next Tuesday we're going to have an extensive hearing on silica mining. We're going to be having the producers come in. They'll be here, and the people that represent them, and the EQB will be back. So if there's any additional questions that you might have of the EQB, or they will be on hand to answer any questions at that time as well. Members, next Tuesday we will be doing that, but on Wednesday we will not be meeting at our regular time. We will not be meeting at all on Wednesday. So we won't have another hearing until the following Tuesday. So we'll hear the silicon sand issue on Tuesday, cancellation of the meeting on Wednesday, and we'll resume our regular schedule the following week. With that, members, meeting adjourned.